What's going on, everybody? Welcome to Whiskey, Web, and Whatnot with your hosts, Robbie the Wagner and Charles William Carpenter III. No jokes for you.
You're waiting. I love that there's a pause for me now.
Yeah, and you do, and I appreciate it. And it either comes to me in the moment or it doesn't. I can't force it, you know?
All right. Well, I'm just not going to stop next time, and you can stop me if you want to say something. But anyway.
I'll interrupt you. It's your favorite thing.
Yeah. Our guest today is Joel Griffith. What's going on, Joel?
Hey, how's it going, folks? Thanks so much for having me. Super happy to be on the show and super happy to have this whiskey with y'all. Though I'm doing a disservice calling it whiskey. It is not technically a whiskey. It's a bourbon. So we'll be clear about that for the purists out there.
Well, you know what they say. All bourbon is whiskey, but not all whiskey is bourbon.
It's true. Leave it to a programmer to like give you the taxonomy back straight. Yep. Like, wait a minute.
Just saying.
That's a good point.
So, before we get into the whiskey, can you give the folks at home a few sentences about who you are and what you do?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Maybe a few more than just a few.
No, three minutes.
Yeah. That's it.
So I'm Joel. Three sentences. Me, Joel, am programmer, work browserless. Yeah, I'm a software engineer turned CEO. Actually, I was a jazz trumpet player turned software engineer turned CEO of Browserless.io. And Browserless was like a side project for a long time of mine, just to try to combat some of the stuff I saw as an engineer, different companies at Elasticsearch, at everything under the sun, Wieden Kennedy, to name a few. We used headless browsers a lot for like little dark corner projects where you needed something for testing or you wanted to, maybe collect data on a site. And it was always a maddening experience every single time, every time. And so that was kind of the genesis of the company. It was like, I really wish somebody thought about this problem a little bit better and was a little more like prescriptive on good things to do when you interact with the headless browser and like maybe some things to think about. And so, yeah, started that 6 years ago, and now it's like a full company. It's not just me anymore, which is, that's what I do today is run that. Still do a lot of code, a lot of programming, managing, all that stuff. So it's been a fun roller coaster for sure. That was more in three senses. I'm sorry.
Hey, Robbie, you're muted.
Oh, yep, you are correct. I was muted. All right, well, I was saying, cool, thanks for that info. We will get more into browserless later, but for now, I will send it over to Chuck so he can introduce the whiskey.
Yeah, the real star of the show. Sorry, Joel. And also, listener, apologize for the lawnmower in the background. It just turns out timing is everything.
Yeah. Anyway. It's fun because the microphone is so good that you don't hear it until you start talking. And then the microphone like activates and I can hear like, brr, brr, like every time you talk.
Brr, yeah. We'll see how that goes. Anyway.
Anyway.
I don't mow my own lawn. I'm sorry. I'm not ashamed. Blanton's straight from the barrel. So this would be Blanton's, for those who don't know, but probably most people do, Blanton's is a single barrel whiskey that is usually 93 proof. So this is barrel proof. They don't proof it down before bottling them out. It is non-age stated, and I don't know what the standard age statement is for Blanton's. I feel like it's 5 or 6 years.
That was my assumption too, I think, from what I've heard.
Yeah, but couldn't confirm it. This one's 129 proof, right? Everybody has 129 proof. It's usually in that range, give or take. Mm-hmm. Mash bill is one of the standard Buffalo Trace mash bills. So they don't give you the specifics, but we know it's corn, rye, and malted barley. And this one's supposed to be a 12 to 15% rye.
Hmm. All right.
From there.
Ooh, can smell the rye in there.
Mm.
Oh, just poured it all over my face.
Have another, Mr. Wagner.
I guess I filled it more than I thought I did.
Yeah, this one's an interesting one. I'll be clear, it's my favorite bourbon I've had thus far in my life. I haven't had a ton, but this is definitely my top. Probably top three.
Okay.
Yeah, on the nose, I don't know. So I just get a lot of caramel
forward.
I mean, a lot of warmth because of the proofing. Caramel. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely get some heat out of that, which always has me leaning towards like a cinnamon kind of thing. Get some of that heat. Definitely.
There's something
a sweetness.
Fresh. I haven't put my finger on it yet. Like lemon's probably not it, but like the same as smelling a fresh lemony cleaner I'm getting from like something.
I think that's the alcohol. Pretty sure.
Always is. I'm leaning towards smell wise, like an orange marmalade kind of thing. So a little rindy, a little sweet, a little, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, on the nose, it's funny. I don't get that on the nose, but on the palate, like I definitely get fruit, like even cherry a little bit, like cherry, maybe even chocolate to a degree.
Some cacao. Got to see how many times we can say cacao.
Or nose. Nose or cacao.
Maybe a dried apricot.
Ooh. That's a very astute palate there.
Yes, yes. Every
it's a joke.
I was gonna say, is that just something you say every time, no matter what it is? Like, ooh, is that dried apricot?
Yeah, I do say it a bunch of times because every single time it makes Robbie laugh, and that just brings me joy, you know. But there is a little bit of like kind of a dried fruit kind of feel to it, or like this is gonna be a weird. It's almost like the way that potpourri smells. Like if you have like a holiday potpourri. Mm. Right, like Christmas time potpourri. It has a little of that flavor for me. I don't think I would recommend anyone to taste that stuff, but that's the closest translation of head wise. What
I do imagine is what this it would taste like that.
Right? Yeah. So
yeah, I think it would be very difficult to chew and swallow, but
again, not with that attitude.
Definitely not for children.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Since Joel is an astute professional and jumped in already with his feelings and senses and like you have good like good palate, good sensory perception around this. So we have a highly technical rating system here you may or may not be familiar with. So 0 because we're engineers to 8 tentacles. The tentacles because of our iconography. And so 0, horrible. I know you're not going to pick that. 4, middle of the road, like this is fine, but not great, not terrible. 8 being amazing. I'm curious how close you're going to hit to that. So yeah, you want to go first?
It's definitely up there for me. I love that your rating system isn't like base 8 or whatever. That's great. Really goes along with the character of the show. Yeah, it's funny because like I feel like there's those rating systems where it's like, oh, 8 is perfection, but you can't technically ever have perfection, so you can never give anything an 8. And that always drove me nuts hearing that. I was like, well, then why is that even on the scale? I have to say it's an 8. I'm going to just do it. I'm going to go out and say it's an 8. Part of it is an 8 for me just because, and we haven't like talked about this, is like the mouthfeel of this bourbon is so incredible. If nobody's had like, you know, barrel strength or cask strength, like it's a totally different experience than just drinking anything that's been cut. Everything after going back to something else after this, it's going to taste like water to me just because of how molassesy and thick this is and like that really nice warmth. And I don't know. So it's definitely an 8 for me. But again, I started off with like, this is like one of my favorite drinks ever. So yeah, for sure. An 8.
Not biased at all.
Not biased.
I love that you swung for the fences on it though. You were just like, hey, guys, do you want to try this one? And then you're like, because I'm going to love it. And don't you want to try one that you think you're going to love anyway?
Yeah. I mean, have you guys had Pappy on the show or anything crazy to that degree? Or is this kind of like the upper echelon of bourbons and whiskeys?
This is. Yeah. So we've not had Pappy on the show. He's dead, by the way.
Wait. Okay. I'm confused now. It was saying you had no microphone. And I was like, maybe that's why it's picking up so much sound that you're just like talking through your computer. Mm. But maybe not. Continue. Sorry.
I was on a roll. Now you've ruined it.
Pappy and something.
Yeah. Pappy and the cleaning of my yard. And it'll be done.
Can you go tell them to not do that anymore.
Yeah. I didn't plan this out well. So anyway, I've had Pappy. We haven't reviewed it on the show, though. I have feelings about it. I would have a hard time paying secondary prices to do that through the show, for sure. And so, but this is on the upper end of cost that we've actually tried. It's not the highest, but we often stay $100 or less, I think.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
Do you want to go next, Rob?
Sure. Yeah, for me, it's very good for a bourbon. I would say, I don't think it's an 8 for me, so I'm going to say 7.1.
You have
a little better than a 7, but
this has unlocked my second pet peeve, which is if you're going to have a rating system from 1 to 10, if you have decimals, just make it 1 to 100. Like, everybody likes, like, this is like the first, one of the first lessons in working with math, especially in JavaScript, is like, just don't have cents. If you're going to do currencies, just don't have cents. Everything, you know, 1 cent, and actually this is like how Stripe and all the other big players operate, is a cent is one. Like, that's the lowest tier of unit you can have. And so that way you don't get into like floating point math hell when you're trying to like divide stuff or, you know, do fancy things like that. But anyways. Sorry, not to knock on.
Yeah, that is smart.
Knock on it, but yeah, just another chaotic, fun thing with rating systems. I find rating systems fascinating. I don't think anybody's unlocked a good rating system just yet. And I don't know. That's a whole other podcast, though.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a general thing. Like, you know, 5 stars, 10 whatevers, they're all arbitrary. It's just kind of like, is it closer to the bottom or the top? That's kind of what we're looking for.
Yeah. I like to look, I mean, distribution, right? Like distribution of ratings. You know, that's where I dive into Amazon. And I notice they progressively like push it lower and lower down so you can't see, you know, but like how many, what, if it's over 10% of 1-star reviews, then I think, nah, that's not good. But anything, if 1-star reviews are less than 10%, then I'm like, okay, that's probably a good sign that is so. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's all fake. Like the companies that want to sell something just hire like 10,000 people to 5-star review it. And like, you never know.
Yep. This is the problem with every industry. I'm coming to learn in my older age is everything is arbitration or middlemen all the way down. There's no truth. It's just more arbitration, more middlemen, more secondary markets. Nothing is right.
Yeah, that's very true. All right, so let's talk a little bit more. Well, actually, let's do hot takes first. I forget how we do this show. So our first hot take, in TypeScript, do you use inferred types or explicit types?
Ooh, I'm going to be honest. I cheated a little bit beforehand in watching the show, and I thought about this a little bit for a few days, so definitely judge me on this because I've thought about it. This isn't on the spot hot take. And my answer to this is I do handwritten types for anything that has like a boundary layer, and everything else I can, I try to do inferred if possible. Internally, at least, just because it keeps the amount of friction and just like development friction to a minimum, I feel like, when it's all internal and you can kind of just infer it and plug and play and go along with your day. But if you're offering like a library, an API, something externally or to an end user, then I'm like, yeah, you gotta be like very declarative about that. I think part of that's coming from like a GraphQL background. For many years, I was a big GraphQL advocate, like when it came out and it was its thing. And that's kind of like a big thing with them is obviously like you declare your types ahead of time and very explicitly, and then you can assume that they're there, handle them more eloquently internally in your handlers. But yeah, so that's it. That's, I don't feel like it's necessarily a hot take. It's more reasonable than anything else. So
yeah. Yeah, a lot of people say it depends, and I think that's essentially what we've got here, that, like, you know, there's a time and a place for both, and I don't think that's wrong, because I've heard from a lot of people, like, if you're a library author, you want to be as explicit as you can, because, like, you want it to be, when people are consuming that, you want it to be, like, if they're inferring types, it to work down that chain better and stuff, and, like, you know, I think if nobody did any explicit types ever, then, like, your chain would be, like, you never know what your thing is, right? Like, I think there has to be some explicit stuff. And I think another big argument that people, where the people that do like it, like to be able to see what it is without, like, hovering it and waiting for, like, everything to load and figure out what it is. And I could see that benefit as well.
Yeah, we have some stuff, and we rewrote our, like, in browserless, we rewrote the core engine to do some fancier things with, like, runtime validation. So we have, like, a little, like, build phase where we essentially look at all the types that our APIs expose or expect, and then we compile that into, like, a runtime validation too, so it happens at runtime when, like, a JSON payload comes back or whatever. And we do, like, pass through some types to a degree. We mostly, like, support libraries like Puppeteer, which, if you're not familiar, is, like, a Chrome, headless Chrome automation library. And some of the unwrapping is really miserable and it just does not work. So it's like unwrap promise, you know, return by type, some function on some method on some property somewhere. And then it's like 0000, like all these different like array indices you have to unwrap. And it's just, yeah, it's definitely like code smell in my mind that something isn't right if I'm having to do all this caroting and brackets everywhere and it's starting to look like spaghetti mess. So,
and I think that's like something that is a good thing for everyone to hear if you're a library author. Like, please just export every single type, whether you think we're going to need it or not. Just export them, so I don't have to be like, oh, well, this thing that used this thing that used this thing, none of them were exported, but I see this function returns this thing with like that passed in as the generic and like all this stuff. So I'm going to just take the return of that and grab the third argument, or like, I don't know, like don't make it so hard. Just export all the stuff in case someone needs it.
Oh man.
Right. Yeah. Even all the pieces and the parts. I know, especially in the open source world, like, I don't know, you just can't be overly opinionated when you're an open source contributor. So why aren't you just pushing it all out there? But really, Joel, I think the question should have been, why didn't you write it in Rust then?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of goes back to the whole, yeah, writing in Rust, or, gosh, Dino probably would have been the other one. So, yeah, quite frank, there's two reasons I didn't write it in Rust. One, I don't know Rust. And I guess there's three reasons. I'm going to take that back. Going to lean into my JavaScript.
You're always addending. Yeah.
Going to lean into my JavaScript background. Say one and then say two and then say three and just dynamically change it on the fly. Yeah, one, I don't know Rust. Two, almost all the libraries that we support and work with are in Node, and so we can do fun things like take like kind of pass through types in our like API surface, so we can just like pass those through most of the time, and that's pretty hunky-dory. And then yeah, the third is like, even though this company's been around for a couple years now, like, it still feels very like startup-y. And so like knowing what the tools you're working with and being comfortable with those and knowing how to do things quickly is really important. And I think sometimes even more important than the right tool for the job necessarily. Probably going to regret that later, yeah. But yeah.
I don't know. I think to a degree, I've started to regress some of my opinions around that, like overthinking the right tool for the job, because most of the time, folks aren't dealing with a load where it would actually make a difference or matter that much, right?
Yes.
Like, you can use a lot of libraries and web frameworks to build apps and do things. And especially in the earlier days, can be in like the first 5 years, 10 years, if
you know, depending on what like your user surface is, because maybe your business doesn't need to unicorn scale and get 2 million users and blah, 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 blah. It actually does really well, you know, at 500 concurrent users or something like that. And a lot of things can handle that load. So like, what are we scaling for? We're scaling for maybe, like we're adding complexity
to
for
show
maybe.
We can.
Yeah, to show we can. We're adding complexity because of hypothetical situations that like, or real situations that like Facebook deals with, but you probably don't, you know, not you, you, but you know what I mean? Like a lot of people making these arguments are just making arguments for like bleeding edge new stuff. You know, it's like saying somebody sucks because they have an iPhone 12. Guess what? It still makes phone calls, texts and stuff. You know?
Yeah, I agree a lot with a lot of what you just said. I mean, the fact is that, yeah, it's what are you scaling for is a great question. Like, are you scaling for your internal organization to be productive? Because that's like the biggest thing to be, you know, good at is like having time to like delivery to almost nothing if possible. You know, Kubernetes is like my favorite example of this is like everybody's like, oh, we got to do Kubernetes. Kubernetes is a new thing. We got to do Kubernetes. And like I was in line at the Kool-Aid stand with my Kool-Aid like cup, like give me some Kool-Aid Kubernetes, and nobody and I got it. And I threw up and I was like, this is not what I wanted. This is, I don't know, that technology, like I'm sure does like what you described, like solves organizational problems for like massive companies where, you know, it's like this service is attached to this service, talks to this database. And so like you want a way to like declaratively, you know, describe that relationship in like something. And yeah, like we even thought about it at Browserless a few times doing Kubernetes, but every time we looked at it, it's like it's the cost and the maintenance is too high for the value it provides for us at this time. So
yeah. Like I think a lot of places like don't even have a solid just one Docker container working well. And then they're like, let me look at Kubernetes. And I'm like,
yeah,
maybe not. They like, think maybe you have other problems first.
Yeah. Now, for like complex automation and scaling, like it solves a bunch of problems there. But there's a ton of configuration that goes around with that orchestration and, you know, a bunch of understanding of the architecture. It's not just figuring out what the YAML files mean. And I got introduced to it in like an enterprise situation doing work for a life sciences business. And they did have the volume, you know, millions of users, couple $1 million business or $1 billion business, sorry. And so it brought some sanity to their world where they were doing a lot of on-prem stuff, very manual, you know, deployment situation. And I got introduced to it then as part of like a project team. I was like, this is so cool and I'm going to start messing with it and, you know, do the have like your home lab set up and do a little bit there. And then you're kind of like, oh, this is a lot just to run like Home Assistant or whatever, you know? So it's like, oh, okay. Now I understand. Yeah. It's not a panacea for all container situations.
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing is like some of the problems that we face and like I want to solve, like all these technologies or a lot of, I should say all of them. I have never used old technologies, so I can't really say that I've used them all, but a lot of these technologies like just kind of rework the rough structure of a wheel, but like all the little details, the nuts and the bolts part seem to kind of get lost. Like even just before this podcast, like I was trying to get something to work with, you know, since we have a headless browser as our service, there's a lot of like REST-based APIs you can use it, but obviously those take a while to respond to. And like, what happens if the request just dies? Like, you know, something happens globally in the network and something goes offline and the request into the service just drops. And it was like trying to give a cat a bath, try to get our like image to understand like, oh, when this is processing, if something happens to that underlying socket, like we should just bail and not return a response and continue. But like most of the frameworks out there just assume that you're going to be able to write a response at the end of the transaction or whatever. And it's like, well, why isn't this more of like a first class citizen to just like exit, you know, request response thing too early? And like none of the frameworks I really looked at seemed to have like an elegant way of handling it. Or if they did, it was like, you got to hook into this event. And when that fires, you got to make sure to clean up elsewhere. And so you just become this thing of like duct taping a bunch of stuff together. And yeah, anyways,
it's funny what you're describing actually sounds like a use case for structured concurrency, right? You want to be able to exit or quit processes, and you want that kind of, that's funny, just because we have some friends, peers who work on a structured concurrency library that kind of came out of an Ember project, like the ideologies, and then they've abstracted that, and that becomes like sort of its own thing. And I've always kind of thought of it of like, that doesn't apply to like 95% of the use cases of projects that I've worked on. Seems like cool, smart stuff. But then what you just described actually sounds like a thing that could utilize that kind of structured concurrency.
You're going to have to send me that library because I would love to take a look at it. Concurrency is a huge thing, or concurrency, I guess, management is a big thing for browserless. As you can imagine, if you've got a machine and it's got like a CPU and 1 gigabyte of RAM, it's not going to be able to have a lot of open browsers at a time, maybe one at that. And so we do have like this concurrency bottlenecking part of our platform that like limits the amount of traffic that can happen at any given time. I don't want to say it's like shoehorned in there, but it kind of is a little bit. It's mostly pretty good, but like, yeah, there's some like things to be desired for sure with, again, with like if something drops off in the middle of that, or, you know, how do you like potentially queue up other things to happen after like 10 are filled in a concurrent slot or whatever. So yeah, I don't know. It's just crazy to me to think that we live in this day and age and the web has been around for so long, and it's like, how come these are still problems that are not easily solved? But it just because maybe I'm in JavaScript, and JavaScript shouldn't have ever left like Netscape Navigator back in the day. It should have just stayed as a one man project.
Should have stayed in its lane in some ways or something of that nature. That's what some people would say, right? Like it's definitely outgrown its initial intentions, for better or worse. We did definitely got a bunch of really smart people coming from those other areas, you know, applying more and more to that and making it real web framework. But, you know, yeah. And then there you go. And are you trying to wedge a solution, or is it maybe at that point you think about, was it the right tool?
Yeah, this is a good end cap for that whole, the right tool or the wrong tool, but fast.
Yeah. Right, exactly. It's like, I know how to do most of the things in this tool. That makes me more productive in it. Maybe there's a time where the challenges become, you know, you need to like a larger mind share for that. I don't know. There's a, you know, as a burgeoning company runner myself, I guess I'll have to think about those things.
Yeah, don't want to keep you up too late at night. I'll say that. And that's got to have that bourbon at some point and let those thoughts go to bed.
I usually start around 2 or 3 Arizona time so that I can accommodate folks on the East Coast. No, Robbie. But yeah, just once a week, hopefully. We do have other hot takes, though. We have gone down a path. Let's make sure we cover all of these hot takes. And because the next ones really, they're very important.
They are.
Yeah. Tailwind or vanilla CSS?
Oh, man. I don't want to use that "it depends," you know, escape hatch right now, but I'm really wanting to grab
it. Gotta pick one.
Yeah. You just wrote yourself into a corner by saying "it depends" is
like
bullshit.
Okay. If you want. Sorry, I'm thinking.
Yeah, your account dashboard is now.
It is.
Tailwind,
yeah.
So I'd be careful on this answer.
Ooh, it is. Okay, I've spent a lot of time as a front-end engineer. I'm going to say Tailwind for sure. The dashboard necessarily, I didn't have that decision. I'm trying to let go of making so many decisions.
Yeah.
I think for writing your own CSS, it's like running a chainsaw. There's a good chance you're going to get kicked back and cut your face off doing it wrong. Like, if you know how to use a chainsaw and you got all the gear and you know, like, oh, if I write this rule in this selector, it might overwrite this other one. And then if you get to the point where you start writing like bang important, then maybe just go to Tailwind. But yeah, I think for folks that are like really knowledgeable with CSS and know like how the weight selection thing works and whatever else, knock yourself out. There's a very high chance you're going to write the wrong abstractions. And that's why I say Tailwind, because they have given this a lot of thought. Yes, it looks like a mess. Your DOM is going to look gross, but you know, most users aren't pulling up DevTools and looking at the DOM to say like, oh, the site looks nice. Let's go look at that markup. Yeah, but that's why I'm probably pro Tailwind. Is just, I think they're really smart people who have seen this, thought about this, and they are going to just know what the right abstractions are. But yeah, again, it depends. I'm sorry.
I'd say for 98% of the use cases, though, again, like for most things you're going to do when writing an application or a static site or whatever else, Tailwind's going to help you do it faster. So that's nice. If you want to do some cool abstractions, I mean, the answer could be both also, right? Like if you want to do some really cool CSS tricks, that's nice. And you want to be a master of your craft in that way. There's kind of a way to do both. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. Or maybe you're a small team and you just want to write CSS. You're just like, you know, it's just me and I want to do it my way and I understand where the limitations lie, so it's not a problem. Then, hey, knock yourself out.
Yeah. You can also write your own everything. Like you can make your own classes for Tailwind, like similar utility classes. You can then compose theirs and yours together. You can make componentized things. You can like anyone that's like, oh, it's not real CSS is like, but it is though. Like it's just classes. And the Tailwind docs are actually some of the best places to learn CSS. Like they're way better than any other CSS docs, in my opinion.
Well, they're not as terse as the spec, that's for sure. So if you can't tell, Robbie bought the t-shirt. So
okay. Well, I'm a big Tailwind fan.
Yeah, it's interesting that the docs actually do a good job of educating you. That's like a great hallmark for good docs, is like you learn more than what you were after for. And I think Chris Coyer, especially for CSS, is like the you know, demigod of that realm. Like I always learn something. Like I'm just trying to get this stupid thing to vertically center, and like you walk away like fixing that problem, but you also learn something in the meantime, which is a big deal, I feel like, for, you know, trying to get out there and like solve problems, but also like educate a little bit at the same time. Yeah, my spiciest take on this is that I would just rather do it like JSS or whatever, the embedded, like in your React component. If you're going to do React, like just put it in the component.
Well, now you're wrong. Now you're just completely wrong.
There is a wrong answer. Yeah.
And it looks like it came up. You added a third option that was not a C, but it was actually a Z.
Sorry. Sorry, not sorry.
You know, you can feel your own way.
I mean, I'll be honest though, front end, having done a large bit of both, you know, I've been a front end and a rear end developer for a long time. And I think
that's what she said.
I think the rear end development's a lot easier than the front end, in my opinion.
God, I love that you just kept up with it.
Go for it. They just asked me to leave at a lot of like conferences and talks. You know, it's like, I'm not a full stack developer. I'm a half stack developer. And they're like, okay, get out. I'm like, fine. I understand your point.
There's a conference here in Phoenix called Half Stack.
Oh, really?
Which is pretty funny.
I was like, why hasn't...
I think they do it Phoenix and like somewhere overseas or something. But yeah.
I always thought it'd be great to have a conference.
Kind of the jam stack.
And call it like the Half Stack Conference. And you just go to some random IHOP and just eat pancakes and talk about, you know, back end development or whatever. And just like not let them know.
Next time is front end.
Yeah, next time is front end.
You should start the Half Stack podcast.
We'll pick one stack and talk just about that the entire time, and always is going to take place in
and eat pancakes
for reasons.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sure there's a way, like you definitely could set up a mobile studio somehow.
I don't think IHOP would stop you if you showed up and were recording.
So I think they'd be happy to have
a paying customer would be good for them right now.
Yeah. Hey, I like some
IHOP. You know, yeah. The international passport Swedish, that's my jam, and the one near me at least is always packed. I've never been to it, but driven by a ton. I have nothing against it, and it's better than Applebee's.
Oh man. Yeah,
well, they own Applebee's, or vice versa. I forget what the parent company is.
Oh, that's funny.
Really? I didn't know that. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Man,
yeah, I think it was like Applebee's bought IHOP, actually, because Applebee's, like everyone thinks, is just out of business, and IHOP is usually like doing okay. But so it felt weird that it was like them buying IHOP. But
Man, Applebee's had this crazy promotion probably a few weeks back where it's like for $1,000 or $500, I can't remember the amount. It's a great deal, a great deal. You buy a year's worth of date nights from them, and on every like Wednesday night, you and your significant other go down to your local Applebee's and you eat a free meal, or not free because you essentially pre-buy all of them for the year. But it's like, you know, how depressed of a person are you when you like think like, oh, that's a great idea, I'm going to do that, and we're going to commit to Applebee's for a year of like weekly or monthly date nights.
I like the idea, but I don't like the restaurant it's at. Like, like if there were a restaurant I loved that offered that, I think that'd be kind of cool. But
yeah, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. I'm really sorry to punch you, Robbie.
Yeah, the last time I went to an Applebee's, it was not a great experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't a great... I think it was one of those things, like, I remember in college, like the early years of college, for whatever reason, in like the Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky area, it was a hot thing to do to go to Applebee's for happy hour, get some wings, get a big Brutus, just a big cheap Bud Light, basically, or Budweiser, Bud Heavy.
Bud Heavy.
And then go out to other places. It was like hopping, blowing up. Oh, yeah, that was a fun thing we did. Didn't really go to Applebee's for quite some time. A few years ago, my wife and I forget what we do. I don't know. We had some date night and we were kind of like out of our normal area. And we're like, I don't know what's around us. Let's just grab something to eat. I guess Applebee's is fine, right? And it used to be fine. Let's go there. People go there. It was very busy. And it was also fucking horrible.
I think,
I don't know if that's specific to that location or what it was, or it's just like generally not that great, but I literally would rather have gone to Taco Bell.
I always would go to Taco Bell.
Oh, well, I would always choose Taco Bell over many fine dining establishments.
Fine.
I like that you just came up with their new slogan, though. It's Applebee's. It's just fine. It's fine.
Well, it's fine is what I was hoping for, of like, you know, this is going to be mediocre and it's like whatever. No, it was like kind of bad. Like I tried I remember again, the college thing. So my standards were low, but they used to like once a year do this all you could eat riblets basket. And of course, you know, you're like 20 or whatever. And you're like, yeah, $10 that and beers because I have a fake ID. Everybody knows I was a bad kid. So this is fine. And that was great for me. You could just load up unlimited calories. I'm into that. But no, I would have turned that away. I would have been like, I won't be finishing the first one. No thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has gotten very, very into whatnot quickly. So I want to regress back. Let's talk about browserless a little bit. Tell us, you know, what's the use case for it? What was your first use case for, like, why'd you start it? Who is it for? You know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I started it originally because I was building a wish list app, right? So like you go to Amazon and you put a bunch of stuff that you want on a wish list and you share it with people, but you're limited to what Amazon has. You can't just add anything off the open internet. And I don't think at the time there was anything that really did that necessarily. And so I ran into, I think it was Target. Like, so the idea was like you could put a link to a product you wanted, and the site I was working on would like kind of parse it out, like get a picture, the price, all of that, just kind of like simple stuff to show. And that way your friends and family could like mark it as bought or whatnot. But ran into target.com, which was at the time an SPA, a single page app. And I couldn't just, you know, do my poor man fetch on their URL and get anything interesting back. So I was like, oh crap, like I have to run a JavaScript engine and a parser to like get anything meaningful back from this. So, you know, as things happen, as, you know, developers like bike shedded that to hell and back and realized, oh, it'd be great if I could use Puppeteer, this new library, to do this for me. Like, this is very simple. I like the API. And it was just really difficult to provision and get headless Chrome running well, and then at the same time support Puppeteer. And so, yeah, back 6-7 years ago, this was like the first, I think, kind of like software as a service that ran, that supported Puppeteer. Everything else, all the like the browser stacks, everything kind of out there at the time just did not support like WebSockets and that sort of protocol. Because usually you have a remote client, connects over WebSocket, talks to the browser. That's pretty high level of how it works. But and so, yeah, I wrote it over a couple weeks. And I was like, I think this is actually more useful than the thing I was working on. So I'm going to see if there's any interest in it. And luckily, there was a bunch of GitHub issues. Anybody's like starting a business today, these are great, great like first tips is like a bunch of open GitHub issues. Like, I can't run this in Ubuntu. I can't run this in like, you know, my random Linux distro. You know, I just go on that and be like, oh, you could kind of do it with this, or you could just use this thing over here, browserless. It'll do it for you. And that's where I got my first users from, which is a big deal for starting a company. How do you get your first users? And so, yeah, it started off with that. And so it's kind of like kind of a web scraping company, kind of a testing company, kind of like a PDF asset screenshot generation company. And it just kind of does all those things and tries to make it a sane experience, because there's a lot of stuff you can get wrong and do wrong when you're running a headless browser and, you know, navigating to a page and it opens a subpage or there's iframes or, you know, you get bot blocked or whatever. Like, those are really difficult to overcome sometimes, and it tries to, like, I guess, level the playing field out there so everybody can be productive and fun with headless browsers. But yeah, that's, and actually, Chris Corey did talk a couple times with it, but our biggest first user was actually CodePen a few years back. I remember getting out of the shower and looking at my phone and seeing somebody at CodePen signed up, and I was like, no. No, yes. Way. They did not. No, stop it. Stripe, you're lying to me. That's just not right. That was a big aha moment for sure. That like I was maybe onto something. So yeah, that's the kind of broad strokes about what it is and all sorts of other fun stuff in there to talk about. But yeah, that's kind of how I got started with it, or the genesis of it, really.
Yeah, I can recall like first being introduced to it and seeing like, could you put together your own Cypress with this? I feel like you could. It's kind of like part of that model, but then obviously you can take it a few different directions. So it's like way more configurable, but you could look at something like Cypress and be like, I could do that myself actually with this setup.
Yeah. There's some really cool, like there's one thing I'm really obsessed with. Like I hate, sorry, if Plaid is listening or a supporter or whatever the show. I hate Plaid. I don't like giving out.
Sponsored by Plaid.
Sponsored by Plaid. You're going to hate it.
This episode is sponsored by Applebee's and Plaid.
It's fine. Give us your credentials to your bank account. We're not going to tell anyone. But like banking is a big one. So like you go like apply for a mortgage, and a lot of times like an online mortgage company will say, great, give us your bank records. And if you don't want to do that, give us your bank account information and we'll have Plaid do it. And first off, that's a violation of a lot of your banking terms of service, just as a heads up to like give out your username and password. And the second thing is like they only use it for that few seconds where they get like your bank statements or whatever, and then they never need it again. But who knows what happened to those credentials you just gave, you know, company XYZ. And so that's where it's still being worked on, but I'm really obsessed with it, is this idea of like hybrid sessions. So let's say you have that workflow, like you're gonna give somebody your banking information instead of like giving them your username and the password. What if they just like gave you like a screen of the browser on their end where you could log in and they could like one time scrape their data you needed, but you could watch it if you wanted to, or you could just log in, let their automation take over, and then after that it's gone. So they don't want to ever see your credentials. They wouldn't, you know, see anything sensitive, get what they need, and then like there's a good like stop at that point. And you know, like, okay, that was secure. I'm not gonna like regret them, you know, having my username, passwords, second factor auth credentials, all that. So yeah, I don't know, there's really like interesting and novel ways. And the reason I bring that up is because Cypress has like really cool ways of like recording your session and like giving you debug information. But I think like that kind of experience can be applied to a whole bunch of other things that we just kind of bear with and deal with right now. But it could be better.
Yeah. On a high level, no matter who's asking, if they're not related to you in particular, don't give out your usernames and passwords and two-factor and all the other things that are put in to stop random people from
listening. I take convenience all the time. I'll give whoever any of my passwords. It's fine. I want to be able to like
say your credit card number and social security number right now.
For convenience.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to go that far.
Listen, if Ken Wheeler can give out his real phone number on here.
Which, we'll get him to give his credit card out next
time. I messaged him. It does work.
I could see him doing that. I could see that happening just to like put it out there.
You could see him doing that by just watching that episode of our podcast. You'll see him do it. He's like, I don't give a fuck.
I got through a good portion of it and I was like, I've had enough Ken for today. I'm going to go to the other Ken C. Dodds now and like balance things back out a little bit.
There you go. The other one. Yeah.
Very different people.
It's very wholesome. Yeah. And we had eggnog with Kent.
Oh. Sorry.
Yeah. So, that was a way to share the experience. You know, we try to be thinking about different ways to include folks who may or may not imbibe. But, you know, sober people are boring. But Kent was really nice, actually. Fun. So we did eggnog. We put a little bit in ours. Mm. He had an eggnog he wanted to try. And that was fun. I don't know if you made it that far or whatever.
No, I haven't even. I haven't even watched that episode, to be honest. So I got to check that out. I hear nothing but great things about Kent C. Dodds, and I've seen some of his, you know, work and like seen him on X or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think like in general, I'm a fan from what I've seen and heard so far, but yeah, I haven't like.
Yeah. He's really nice. He's very helpful. He's open to discourse without getting like ragey. As some folks do. Yeah. So
it's hard to make him mad.
I recommend. Yeah.
But
you can do it. I've seen people.
Yeah. If you do it, I bet it's like
the rage.
Possible.
Comes.
Watch out. Yeah.
Yeah.
The C comes out.
Yeah.
Darn it to heck.
Yeah. If you do it and he calls you out for something, like everyone else will pile on of you're wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love being wrong on Twitter anyway, because like it's all superficial bullshit. I don't know. Like, whatever. We're all in different lanes solving different problems with some similar tools. Yeah. And, you know, it's like if there was one right answer, we wouldn't even be in this industry, right? Like what I love about coding is like, actually, it's funny. It's like part of my career path is that I came up through more of a design. I was a web designer for a bit, and I was asked by the VP of marketing at a company I was at one point is like, I kind of see these as separate. Like there's the design and some of like the UI, and then there's kind of more code and more interactivity. Mm. And like, I think these are separate jobs. And so I think you should pick one. And I was really tired of my manager micromanaging me, not him, but like someone else, and being like, I think these rounded corners on these buttons need to be 8 picks. You have them at like 5 picks. I think they need a little more of that. And instead of a green button, it should be more of a cornflower blue. And it was just a way to like, you know, feel like you were part of building this thing. And I was tired of that. Yeah. And I was like, okay, it's so subjective here. I'm going to go over here where they're just asked to like, you know, make sure in the end someone can like have a cart and check out and like buy stuff. And you can solve that problem a billion different ways. And now we need to look at like, what are the potential different combinations of like size and color or, you know, that kind of stuff. So I was like, now this is fun. This is like, give me a problem. Show me the end result you want. And then I get to figure it out.
Yeah, I agree a lot with the whole, like, there isn't one way to solve a problem. And I think I in particular had a hard time in school just because I feel like all like standard education, at least when I was a kid, was geared towards like, you're just regurgitating the fact. And so like, there's like this opposition to that almost in a way, but like programming, it's way different. I mean, programming or, you know, web service, whatever, web apps, anything, there's not necessarily a clear cut path to do everything. And that's what I like about it. And that's actually the projects I like to gravitate towards. And it's probably why browserless was a thing, is because it's like one of these things in the corner that everybody uses and does, but nobody like says, oh, maybe you should think about it this way or do things this way. I don't know. I love those kind of problem spaces where it's like there's not a clear answer or there's not a clear like prior art. It's just kind of a this weird nebulous where people kind of have to figure it out and maybe come up with some, you know, best practices or whatever. Those things are pretty pretty fun to me.
There's more than one way to skin a cartoon cat or fox, whatever that is in the background there. Oh, wait.
Yeah. Well, speaking of background and speaking of fun, I wanted to ask, what's your favorite Zelda game? I see your shield back
you
there.
You stole my question.
Yeah. I mean, this is going to date myself a little bit. I was a kid when Ocarina of Time was out. I shouldn't say I was a kid. I think I was around high schoolish.
Yeah. Chuck was the age he is now when Ocarina of Time came out.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, you're such a baby. Isn't Ocarina of Time like N64?
Yeah, that's my favorite probably console of all time is Nintendo 64. And so Ocarina of Time was my favorite. I was like, for two reasons. The first is like you leave like your first area, Kokiri Forest, and you get out to Hylian Field and you're like, this game is so big. I can't believe how big this game is. And then you get done with spoiler alerts. Game's been out for 20 plus years. Figure it out.
Yeah, you had not a spoiler.
When you finally like beat the quest as a kid and then you go to adult Link, because I thought that was the end of the game. I was like, hey, we're done. We got all the gems. Yes. Bitch, we're ready. Let's go. Roll the credits. And then I was like, holy he's an adult now? And we got like 6-9 more dungeons to do? I was like, oh my.
And you can go back and forth.
Yeah, they did
like,
that.
They really thought about that mechanic. I mean,
it was like one of the first 3D games, really, that commercially successful 3D games. And they did all this cool stuff on top of just that. Like, not only did they figure out like targeting, but they had like this like interwoven time storyline where you go back and fix things and come back in the future. I was just like, Lord have mercy. Like, there's so many like groundbreaking things in that game. But, you know, Breath of the Wild also brought a lot of those things back to me, too. Like, I remember leaving, like, the tutorial area for the first time, and I was like, oh, this feels like when I was a kid, and you leave the forest for the first time in, you know, Zelda or Ocarina of Time. So, yeah.
You get to the glider, and then you're like, oh, now I'm actually in it. Yeah. I was in this very constrained portion.
And it's huge.
Oh, man. How far are you in Tears of the Kingdom?
Oh, good question.
Yeah, no spoilers on that one. I haven't started yet.
I'm on my second start through because I started it originally like a couple years back and then we moved and just life caught up and I was like, I can't do this right now. So I'm on my second start. So I'm only a few hours into it. Part of me has a love-hate thing with Tears of the Kingdom because during COVID, I was like, why didn't they have this game? Everybody be buying this game like crazy. We're all locked up, nothing to do. Like,
they kept delaying.
They kept getting delayed. Like, if there ever was a time to release a Zelda game, now was the time. But then it was pretty much after the fact that they released it. And so I was like, I'm disinterested now. I got work and crap to do again. So don't bug me. I'm an old man yelling at clouds again.
Yeah. And then you come crawling back, though. They always do.
Yeah.
No, but it's funny, though, because it's like Breath of the Wild, but then now it's, you know, not quite tripled, but kind of, because you have the subterranean zone, you have the sky zones, and you just, I don't know, there's so
I didn't know
much.
There was.
I mostly have spent.
I didn't, know, didn't there know there was. Thanks for the spoiler, Charles. I didn't know there was a, subterranean. Now,
I don't feel like I'm giving away too much. It's not like I'm telling you where the master is.
See, some of us have to do work, so we haven't played the game, but.
Some of us mow our own lawns, okay?
Well, I don't.
You don't anymore. Robbie used to. He lived on a farm for like a month. And then he was like, I hate this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically.
But yeah. Yeah. No, I'm.
Yeah. I played a lot of Diablo because it came out like the same time, I think. Or like maybe Tears of the Kingdom was out a couple months ahead of that.
The second one?
And then I
was
like.
Overlap.
Yeah. And I never had the time to start it, and then Diablo came out, and I played that, and then like I was busy. And
didn't you play that Harry Potter one or something too?
I did play the Harry Potter game for a while.
World. Yeah, I didn't play that, but I usually play like FIFA, I play soccer video games, and then Zelda games come out, and they kind of absorb all of my time for a while. And I don't do a lot of bouncing around. I did Skyrim for sure. That was like an amazing immersive world on the Switch. I don't know if that was because they had like a re-release right before pandemic, so it might have been.
Yeah, Skyrim came out in 2011. So
dang,
yeah, but
it was
the,
definitely a
the
re-release.
Switch port. Yeah, but the Switch port was like timely for me. That's a fun one where you can like go through half the quests and then like keep your companions with you. And then you end up building like, you know, a group of three or four different people that help you because you never like finish the quest and let them move on.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's my pro tip for Skyrim.
Well, I haven't played Skyrim yet, so I'm going to have to give that pro tip a give it a try.
Skyrim's really fun. Yeah.
It is really fun, actually. Yeah. I was like, no, this both, is amazing.
Yeah, both that and Diablo. I did play a little bit of Diablo 3 with some friends during COVID, and almost was like on the precipice of becoming addicted to it. And then I realized what was happening because I had a really bad streak when I was younger with World of Warcraft. And I remember
that'll get you.
Remember like one point, like going to bed at like 7 a.m. and thinking, oh boy, I got a problem. Like, oh boy, this is not good.
Yeah.
So I was like, I should probably watch this a little bit.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Everything in World of Warcraft was so slow though. Is like why it took forever, but it was like that little bit of gratification every like, you know, a couple minutes or whatever, and so you just hooked forever.
Yeah, it was really, yeah, you're right. It was painful, but it's like part of it was the journey, not the destination. Like, oh, am I gonna get in the server? Oh, yes, I did. Great, and I can finally go do this thing and go sell this thing on the auction house or whatever. But yeah, man,
yeah,
good times.
Yeah, yeah. Blizzard does a good job with pretty much everything they make.
You haven't played 4, though. Diablo 4, are you? Is it? Yeah, the 4 is the recent one, right? I haven't touched that one yet.
Yeah. 4 is pretty good. It's, I still think 2 was the best, but like you're never going to get that again. So 4 is better than 3.
Mm.
So I would recommend checking it out if you like Diablo games. I think 4 is pretty good.
I mean, they re-released 2, if I remember right. Reskinned it, really. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I played some of that. But I don't know. The magic was just not there anymore. Like, it's still really fun, but it's just like there aren't as many people playing it. And it was just like, I don't know.
Novelty's gone.
Didn't feel the same. Yeah.
Yeah, it's too bad. But this is a great metaphor for what the web is like right now. A great recap of technologies is we're just reskinning and re-releasing the Diablo 2 of the past most of the time.
We're just reskinning and re-releasing PHP.
FIFA.
Yeah, we
That's
are.
A hot take. PHP in Undercell. Which actually can happen, but that's a whole separate other
seriously?
Story. I did experience a project where someone had used Vercel for a WordPress setup. And you can do it.
Why?
You
get out of here.
Yeah, exactly. Why is a good question. Like, I understand that, like, I don't know, how hard is it to put WordPress on AWS? I feel like that's got to be one of the most straightforward releases you could do if that's the way you want to go. But you also could just find, like, a GoDaddy VPC and auto-install, which is what I did many, many years ago. You just, like, get into a, you know, a virtual server. Get your little part of it, hit auto install WordPress, and then you get, you know, root access through things. Do your plugins, done. I don't know. But yeah, I did come across this a year or so ago, and I was very surprised that it was a WordPress on Vercel. So you heard it here. You really can release anything there.
Oh, man. If you want.
It's not just Next.
That is just, not even that, getting it to run is one thing, but like what happens when you run into issues, you're not going to find any like resources at all on that. Like,
because no one else is doing it. No, probably 100%.
The people that did it were probably on Arch Linux, and they like being the ones that did the one thing.
Yeah, it was a weird hybrid app where like essentially the consumer facing side was WordPress and the admin side Next. And they just kind of decided to make it all one thing. The database was PlanetScale. Like, I don't know. Is this strange, like, Frankenstein of, like, new and old technologies? And it was just like, I don't know how you landed here, but you did. And here's where we're at. And so let's see what we do.
What circumstances in your life led you to this moment? Oh, man.
I think that's an offline story. Anyway.
Yeah. So we have one question that we always ask everyone that we do want to get in here before we end. If you weren't in tech, what other career would you choose?
Oh, that's a Great question. Well, I think I'm going to take another escape hatch one on this one, because I was not in tech to be starting with in my life. So, man, old Blanton's catching up with me. Old man Blanton. But I was originally a musician and a jazz trumpet player prior to tech. And that was, I guess, my first love, even though I kind of grew to hate it, as you know, you do with your first loves a lot of the time to a degree. But yeah, I'd probably get back into that a little bit. Or I don't know, man, if it wasn't for that, that's a fantastic question. Honestly, I'd probably just be like a 1-800 junk ripoff. Just go to people's houses, help them get rid of shit. Like that is gratifying to me. And I just like helping people. I think that's like something I've learned about myself as I've gotten older, is like the process of helping somebody that probably can't help themselves. There's a lot of like really good fulfillment I get out of that. And so, yeah, it would just be fun to drive an old beat up pickup truck and, you know, throw shit away. That'd be amazing. And it's,
that's a very, you know, like West boss like answer too, where it's like, if you weren't doing this, you know, you would find some very like very baseline, not sexy, but everybody needs kind of service. He was like, oh, I would probably like open a storage facility or something like that. Well, you know?
Yeah.
You get such a great like gratification too from it at the end of the day. Like there was this room where all this stuff was in a pile and now it's not. And so, you know, especially with programming too, it's, since it's so abstract and it's not necessarily tangible, it's like, I can't still like go home to my wife and be like, hey, I just refactored this whole code base and look how nice it is. It lint's fine. Prettier isn't crying anymore. Like, but
if your wife is like mine, yeah, she's like, shut up, I'm falling asleep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm going to have to tell my wife about linting tonight and see what she thinks.
See how that goes. I can't wait to hear about this. It's going to be great.
Oh man. You should ask her about semicolons. Right. And if, are you pro or anti-semicolons? There's a lot riding on this.
She likes Python, I heard. So, yeah.
She likes what?
No, she likes Python.
Python?
No. She likes Python. No semicolons, no brackets. She's like, nope. Just feels natural.
Nope. Feels wrong.
No Wagner, whatever, Python in my house. Anyway. All right. Have another.
All right. We are over time. Do you want to plug anything before we end?
Oh, you know? No, I don't. Thanks.
This all episode right, was cool, brought to you by Velour Tracksuits.
Yeah, go buy some velvet tracksuits. Listen, actually, that is one thing I will plug, kind of on the self-care side. Like, you know, guys that build fences or dig ditches, they get geared up for the job they're going to do, right? Like, if you want to get in the mode of doing your thing, don't be afraid to wear velvet tracksuits or change your lights to blue or green or red, whatever kind of gets you in the mood. Because that, like, actually does help a lot. So, yeah, like, don't be afraid to, like, listen to what your body's telling you. I mean, people do with keyboards and stuff like that, but there's more to it than just that. There's, like, the outside, you know, peripheral stuff that makes a difference. So, yeah, take care of yourself.
Yeah, that's good advice.
I like it.
All right, cool. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. If you liked it, please subscribe, leave us some ratings and reviews. We appreciate it, and we will catch you next time.